Welcome to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going over there in Brazil, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing really great, John. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. It's kind of funny because, well, I had my third COVID vaccination shot on 2 days ago as of now, which I'm very, very happy about having that done. But, you know, the day after a vaccination shot, you usually have some different kind of symptoms, like different people get different things. And for me, it's been kind of the same for all three shots. It's been like a day where I have a lot of fever, I'm very tired and so on. And so I slept almost the entire day yesterday. I was just sleeping the whole day. And that means that when I woke up this morning, I was like so well rested. Like it was incredible. So I had this like burst of energy and I implemented 7 different features in one of my client projects just like during the morning and just sent them like, you know, here's 7 new features. And they were like, wow, this is incredible. I was like, yeah, I had a pretty productive morning. So it's funny how it works this way, you know, biology and all those things. But now I feel really, really good. And I am happy to be once again fully vaccinated.
Yeah, I definitely agree that sleep is the best thing you can do to your health. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I'd say many things that you feel are wrong with you could be due to a lack of enough or good quality sleep. And it's funny that, again, this comes up every now and then. People ask us, do you ever sleep? Because it seems like we do so much stuff. And as a matter of fact, we do. And I sleep at least 7 hours every night. At least I try to. Once a week, sometimes, like I'll do like between 5 and 6, which is really low for me. I really feel the effect the next day because I'm so used to sleeping 7 to 8 hours per night. When I sleep less than 7 hours, I can definitely feel it. But fortunately, tonight, this last night, I slept more than 7 hours, so I'm very well rested and I'm ready for some Stack Trace.
That sounds awesome. Yeah, I think we've discussed this before, but I also really don't want to cut back on sleep even when I have a busy schedule. So usually, you know, if I have to, I try to always take like at least a few hours every day where I don't do any work, where I play video games and I cook food and I just relax, take a walk with my dog and so on. But if I have a like incredibly busy schedule, because I think we've all been there, right? Where you have some kind of deadline coming up and you have to put in those extra hours for whatever reason. And sometimes I'm fine with that. It's like, for example, during WWDC, I know during that week I will work what I would consider an unhealthy amount of hours, but it's just 1 week. So I'm fine with that. And then I take like the week after to relax and recharge. And that's an equation that I can kind of balance that way. But I never want to cut back on sleep. So even during WWDC, I make sure to sleep at least like 7 or 8 hours per night. So I'm well rested, because the thing is that I found, at least personally, if I cut back too much on sleep or relaxation and so on, it's not actually making me more productive. It's actually the opposite, where if I will try too hard to push myself and to get like every hour out of every day to do work and to be productive, it's not going to work. Like, I'm actually going to perform worse and I'm going to actually be slower at my work. While, like I mentioned this morning, like I spent just a few hours on a client project and implemented 7 different features because I was so energized. I just had like this clarity in my head and I could just code very quickly and get everything done. And I feel like this is something that is also important to keep in mind, is that you don't always get more productive just because you work more hours. It's more like how you work rather than how much you work, I would say. And of course, that differs between different people and different professions and what you do and so on. But I think for me personally, as a programmer, the work I do is pretty intense in terms of just I have to think a lot, I have to solve problems, I have to think about architecture and all those things, and I have to balance requirements with implementation and so on and so forth. So I feel like I really need to be well-rested to do my work. And, well, I just make sure to be well-rested as much as possible.
Yeah, it's a bit like the mythical man month for people. Like, if you add more people to a project, it's not necessarily going to make the project go any faster. And I'm talking about software projects specifically here. And I guess the same also applies to putting more work hours into your thing that you're trying to achieve. I think for most people, if you are trading sleep in order to get those extra hours or just resting in general, you're probably not going to get the productivity out of it that you feel like you're going to get. So the way I quote unquote fixed that in my own professional life was to start to analyze what's distracting me during those productive hours.
Right.
And if you start to really look into it, you're going to find a lot of things that are taking away your focus and taking away your ability to perform as well as you could that you can probably address in some way. Of course, it's easy for me to say, like, I live by myself, I don't have kids or anything like that. Let's have this conversation again when I have my puppy, which I will have soon. And it's probably going to be different. But even then, like, besides like the kids or something else, there are things you can probably do to increase the throughput during those hours that you are being productive.
Yeah, because I'm the kind of person, I would rather work like a fewer amount of hours, but really get the most out of them rather than kind of drag things out just for the sake of it. And I think for me, the very big kind of eye-opening moment there was when I started becoming a freelancer and I was required to track my time, where before I wasn't interested in tracking my time at all. When people would suggest it to me and they would say, like, you should try tracking your time, it's really great for productivity, I would say, ah, that sounds stressful. That sounds like an unnecessary complication. I don't want to do that. But then once I started working like by the hour, right, I have to track my hours in order to, you know, present to my clients what I did and how much money they owe me and so on. But that was also like a huge eye-opening moment in terms of productivity where I realized that I can be more focused when I know how much time I'm spending on different tasks. And because I have that timer running and a client will eventually pay for that time, that also just personally makes me more focused. Like I'm not going to go to Twitter or I'm not going to check my email or something while that timer is running. And that just turns out to be a great productivity tool because you don't have to check Twitter every hour, right? Like you don't have to check your email every hour. You can just do it like in certain intervals throughout the day. And for me, like having that time tracking running has really helped with that the kind of focus time. And of course, there are different techniques you can use here. I know there are certain apps people use to kind of keep themselves focused. And I think even with the new focus modes that Apple have introduced, maybe you can use that for these kinds of productivity setups as well. There's a lot of things you can do, but I think it's worth exploring those at least a little bit because it's really fascinating just how much you can, like, quote unquote, hack your own productivity. Yeah. And like we mentioned, it has almost nothing to do with whether you sleep or not. In fact, you definitely should be sleeping, right? It has more to do with what you actually do during those work hours. And I think that's really where you can squeeze the most productivity out of your work.
Yeah, I've also seen a very easy to perceive difference related to the quality of my sleep the past night and the quality of my day. I'm using our sponsor, which is not sponsoring this episode, but has been a sponsor in the past, Pillow, to track my sleep. And it's usually like if the quality is below 90%, I'm going to notice it during the day. So it has to be at 90% or above.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of sleep, that's something I have been researching or rather writing about and using a little bit throughout the past couple of weeks. And I'm not talking about sleep for humans. I'm talking about sleep for tasks. So Rambo, are you ready to enter into John's concurrency corner once more?
Let's go. It's been my favorite corner these past few weeks.
Awesome. So one question that I had once I started adopting Swift's new concurrency system is, how can you delay certain tasks for being performed at a later time? And sometimes when you hear about that, it might seem a little bit counterintuitive, where it's like, why would you want to delay a task? Don't you want it to just be performed as fast as possible so the user can continue with whatever they're doing? But sometimes we might want to introduce a little bit of kind of artificial delay into our programs for various reasons. Like, of course, it might have to do with something like an animation where you probably wouldn't use Swift's concurrency system to do that, but you could have an animation that consists of multiple parts, and maybe you want to do like a scale in and a fade in effect at the same time, like a scale up animation. And you might want to start the fade in and then start the scale up like 0.5 seconds later or something. And that could be a use case for adding some kind of delay to your program. But in terms of concurrency in particular, there are some situations that you might want to use delays to actually create a faster feeling user experience, which again is a little bit counterintuitive, but let me give you an example. So let's say that you navigate to a new screen within an app, and that screen is to load some data from the network and then display it. The kind of simplest way to implement that would be to, in your, let's say you're using UIKit, so you have a view controller, and in your view controller's like view will appear method, you start an asynchronous task. So in the new concurrency system, that would be using the task type. And in there, you would call, for example, await loader.load, right? And you would load your model. And then once the loader has finished and you got your model, you call some method to display it, like display model, and then that's it. But then the question is, what happens if the model loading will be quite quick? For example, there might be a cache of the model already, so it can be displayed quite quickly. There might be like just a cache also on the server side or something like this, where you might need to do a network call, so it will take a few milliseconds, but maybe the network connection is really fast and that call will return very quickly. Well, you could end up in a situation where if you show a loading spinner before you start loading your data, which you probably should, or some kind of loading indicator, and then the network call or the loading operation will be very quick. You can see this kind of flash, like this glitch in the UI, where you see the loading spinner for like 100 milliseconds, then it disappears and your data starts being visible. And what I'm saying there around like it can be perceived as slower or glitchier than it actually is, it can be because of those situations. So a very kind of common good practice would be to delay the showing of the loading spinner for just a few milliseconds in case that network call is very quick. And here you have to play around with some parameters and timing and so on to see like what actual timing would be the best one. And you might also want to do something where you show the loading spinner for a minimum amount of duration before you actually hide it, again, to prevent those glitchy experiences. And so that's something that I was looking into when it comes to the new concurrency system, like how to do that. Because with things like Grand Central Dispatch, we have dispatchQ.async after, where we can just like say asynchronously after this amount of seconds perform this operation. But with the new concurrency system, you are actually going to use a method called task.sleep. And that's where we're coming back to the segue I originally made around sleep. And this is kind of funny because there is another function called sleep, which is a C function that exists on multiple platforms, including Apple's ones, where you can say sleep and you pass in a number of seconds, but that will actually block the current program execution. So
that's
it will just
dangerous.
Completely... Yeah, it's very dangerous. It will completely stop the program execution for a given amount of time. And so a lot of programmers, myself included, have learned that you shouldn't use this function unless you really, really have to, right?
Yeah.
Like it's like I said, it's very dangerous. But task.sleep is very different, where if you're performing that inside of another asynchronous task, you are just making that particular task sleep or wait for a certain amount of seconds or even nanoseconds you can specify. So it gives you control over the timing of a task, which enables you to do things like only show the loading spinner after like 200 milliseconds or show it for a certain amount of duration or any other kind of situations where you might want to cause some delay, maybe some kind of debouncing thing where you don't want to perform a network call every time the user types a character into a search field. You want to delay that for a certain amount of milliseconds. So that's just been interesting to look into, like how to take this concept of delaying tasks and implement it in a way that feels native to the new Swift concurrency system.
Yeah, adding artificial delays, as weird as it may sound, especially to people who are not developers, I guess, is something we do all the time. And it's something that has to be made easier by the tools as much as possible. Because if you do it yourself and you don't do it correctly, you can end up with some serious race condition type bugs and things like that. Every time timing is involved, you can have weird, unexpected states and things like that can happen. One thing I use delays for a lot is for coalescing stuff.
Right.
So say you have a thing that can notify you. So taking an example from everybody, let's say I have something that tells me every time a device has changed. Let's say your AirPods change 5 times within 2 seconds. Do I need to like update the UI 5 times? Probably not, right? So that sort of thing I wrote like quite a long time ago, a coalescing type thing where I can just tell it what type of data it's going to be coalescing and how much time it can wait and how much time it's allowed to wait. Because if you coalesce for, say, 0.5 seconds and you get this thing that's notifying you every 400 milliseconds, then your action is never going to fire because right. It's never going to reach the coalescing time. So I also have the ability to set a limit, like wait for at most 1 second, for instance, or 2 seconds or something. So that's a really great example of what you'd use an explicit delay for something. Something else as well, which has to do with user experience, is putting up a loading indicator where usually you wouldn't have a loading indicator. And that sounds weird, but I think we mentioned it before, but there are some things that users expect to take processing or take time, even if that time is just 1 second. But I had to do that in AirBuddy during the onboarding, and this hasn't shipped yet, but it will. So during the onboarding, there's this step where the app actually installs itself. And installing it is basically running a launch CTL command to load the helper. And that happens pretty much instantly. But some users get confused by it and they think it didn't work because it happens too quickly and there is no loading indicator or anything. So I actually show a little loading indicator for like a second or so, I think maybe even less than that. Just enough that it looks like it did something, you know? So,
yeah.
Just because, yeah, it's something that's kind of funny when you think about it. But you think, well, people are going to be happy that this happened instantly, but in reality, some people are going to be confused and think that it didn't work because it happened too quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one really important aspect of any kind of user experience design is feedback, right? Like yeah. Giving the users good feedback for whatever actions that they're performing, whether that is like installing the application, like making sure that it's clear that this actually succeeded, or things like, you know, performing an action in an app or something like that. Like a lot of apps will make that crystal clear by showing some kind of overlay or something to say like, yes, you did delete this thing or whatever. And I think this is a really important point, is that if your UI is too fast, if things happens too quickly, it can be really hard for the users to see what is actually going on.
Yeah, another example from AirBuddy again. If you have the auto switching enabled on your AirPods and whatnot, connecting to them is most of the time just switching the output of the Mac to be the AirPods. And that also happens pretty much instantly. But even then, I still show a little like connecting thing really quickly, just so that the user knows that it's doing the thing.
Right. Yeah, it makes total sense. And another interesting thing that came up as I was doing a little bit extra research into this task sleep API and tasks in general was, how is come it's possible that you can create an asynchronous Swift task, you provide it with a closure of something you want to run in the future, and in there, you can call whatever methods you want on the current object, so on self, and you don't need to reference self. And that is very different from using, for example, a dispatch queue, where if you do dispatch queue just .main.async, that is an escaping closure. And when you have an escaping closure in Swift, if you're referencing a reference type, like a class or an actor, you need to capture that with self in order to make it explicit. And that's to may give you some extra, speaking of feedback, so that you know when you are actually capturing an object as to avoid accidentally causing retain cycles, where if you capture self inside of a closure that is owned by self, well, then you have a retain cycle, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting that in those tasks that you don't have to do that. Like, how come we can have this closure that is going to be executed later because it's asynchronous and we don't have to capture self within it? Like, we don't have to say self dot, you know, whatever property or method you're calling. And at first I thought this was due to just some kind of quote unquote compiler magic, yeah, where maybe Apple has like added some specific rule in the compiler to say that when you're creating an asynchronous task, you don't have to specify self because we will just take care of it for you. The compiler will make sure everything is working. And it turns out that it is a little bit of compiler magic, but it's actually done through an attribute, which is one of those kind of semi-public attributes that exist in Swift, where it has an underscore in front of it. So it's probably not something that you want to rely on in your own code, because not only could the symbol name change in the future without any kind of notice, but the behavior could also change in the future without any notice. So it's something that is a little bit risky to rely on in your own code. But with the attribute underscore implicit self capture, you can achieve the same results even in custom code as well. And again, I don't encourage anyone to actually go and write code using that, but it's just interesting to see how this actually is working from the system's perspective. So all of the closures that you pass into a task instance in Swift is marked with that underscore implicit self-capture attribute, and that's how you don't have to reference self manually anymore. The like the attribute implies, it's implicit, so self will be captured by that task. And at first it might seem like that's a little bit dangerous, like couldn't that cause a lot of retain cycles? And not really, because the thing is that with Swift tasks, they are not retained by our own classes. Like even if we hold on to like a task handle in order to be able to cancel it later or something like that, the task itself is not retained by our class. It's retained by the system and executed by the system. So I'm sure you could find a way to cause a retain cycle using the system, but it's very unlikely. It's the same reason why we don't have to use a self reference when we're using structs, because it's also very, very unlikely that that will end up causing a retain cycle. So I guess they just made that choice here to make the syntax a little bit more lightweight, and that that trade-off was worth it because the risk is so low in this particular type of situation.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Speaking of that attribute, if you know in some context that you don't have to worry about retain cycles, since Swift 5 dot something, I want to say, you can do just self in, and then it becomes implicit within the closure. So if you have a situation where you're not using the new async await stuff, you're just using plain old closures, and you know that it's fine to capture self in there, you can just put self in, not weak, not unknown, just self in, and then you can omit self within the block.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. And there are cases also where you might want to retain self. For example, if the object itself isn't retained by anything, like it's some kind of operation that you're just firing, like a task, then you might want to retain self in there in order for it to be retained in memory as you perform this operation. Of course, it depends on what you're doing, and sometimes you might want to kind of cancel out of the operation by having a weak reference, and then that will just become a no-op in case the self-reference goes out of memory. But yeah, it was just interesting to find out that there's this attribute involved here and that they've made this decision when it comes to the memory management in this case, which, again, I think it's the right trade-off here because it just makes the syntax feel so much more lightweight. And yeah, it just makes it easier to use this new concurrency system.
Yeah, the way I tend to go about it in order to not have a lot of self dots in my code is to just defer that to a separate method in my class, for instance. So I have the callback, I'll just, within the callback with a weak self, of course, depending on the situation, call another method on self that handles the result instead of implementing the actual handling within the callback itself. I think it also makes things easier to read.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it also has the benefit of, like, not only do you not have to do like self question mark everywhere, but you can more easily access all of your data. Yeah. And usually also it can help with compile times, because if it's one thing that the compiler really, really struggles with is closures when it comes to inferring the types of closures.
Oh yeah.
And if you would just have like a simple input type and just call a method on self and then that's it, then that's usually way faster to compile. Of course, it varies a little bit on the case by case, but in general, like just methods in a class compile very, very quickly compared to closures. So I also, these days, I try to avoid putting too much code inside of closures if I can avoid it, both because I think the code becomes easier to read, but also it actually really helps with compile time. And also, like, it gives you better compiler errors if something is wrong. Like, so many times, I think a lot of Swift developers have gotten errors which are like, you know, this type does not match this type, when it's like, you misspelled a variable inside of your closure. You know, like the compiler error becomes very misleading. And if you instead delegate all of that logic to a method that you just call in that closure, well, you're going to get way better compiler errors most of the time. And you could argue it's a bit unfortunate that it is this way, and that ideally, you know, closures and methods and everything should compile equally fast and give you equally good compiler error messages. But with type inference and these things, especially when we're talking about generics, it can be quite a hard problem to solve, to actually like infer the type inside of a closure if you're just returning something dynamic. So I also get it why it's harder for the compiler to do this. So we can give it a little bit of a helping hand, at least until these two things are equally fast and equally reliable.
I think a good benchmark for the Swift team at Apple could be to use Swift UI's new table view, because every time I've tried to use that, the compiler just gave up on me. Like after like a 3 to 4 columns of a table, it just can't figure out what you're trying to do and just throws up its little compiler hands and goes, nope, can't do this.
Yeah, it becomes almost like a, you know, complexity squared kind of problem, right? Where there's this one type in this one closure that depends on the other type in the other closure and the other type in the other closure. So it becomes just like increasingly more complex for the compiler to infer those types. And of course, you can always add your own type annotations to help the compiler out and so on. But yeah, hopefully we can get into a state in Swift where everything just resolves very, very quickly. But I really appreciate that this is a hard problem to solve.
Yeah, I do appreciate it as well. And I guess I have some feedbacks to file. I've been trying out the new Swift build system integration in Xcode 13.2, and I do like it quite a bit. It does seem to make things a lot faster, and it fixes a long-standing issue I've had with Xcode, which is when you have a lot of warnings and errors in your project, which sometimes, like when you're doing a big refactor or something, it tends to happen. Even typing becomes sluggish in Xcode, that new build system has fixed that, but it has also broken a lot of stuff alongside. So, yeah, gonna have to file some feedbacks for that. They're asking for it. It's disabled by default, but I am brave, so I am testing it.
Yeah, and it can be one of those things that could be good to opt into from time to time just to test it. But when you do your builds on your continuous integration machine, for example, for release, you probably want to opt out, at least for now, right? Because it's, you know, an opt-in kind of... Apple doesn't usually call these features beta. I don't know if they've called this one beta. I guess it's just like disabled by default, which in Apple terminology means beta.
I mean, you have to run a default write command to enable it. So they haven't even bothered putting up a UI for it. So I guess it's not even at beta stage yet, which is totally fine. Like, I'm happy that they've included this, and I'm happy that they are doing this testing at what seems like early stages of the feature, because you can imagine, like, Apple definitely has a lot of projects internally that are quite complex and things like that, but they do need this stuff to be actually tested on real production projects out there with different configurations and Cocoa Pods and whatnot in order to figure out like what's going wrong with this new system. So I'm really happy that they're doing this test.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really great. So Rambo, we mentioned on a couple of episodes ago that you've been opening up a new company and you have the new Best Buddy Enterprises ready to take over the world. And associated with that, I know that you had to migrate your Apple developer account from being a personal account to a business account. And this is something that we sometimes hear these horror stories about where, you know, someone is trying to transfer an app, for example, and they couldn't do it because it used iCloud, and then it becomes locked and you have to contact Apple and so on. It can take a while. So what was your experience doing this kind of transfer? Can you perhaps tell us a little bit about what were you transferring and how did that all go?
Yeah, so I'd like to discuss this here because I think it's something that's not very common for you to see like a full report of a person's experience with this process. And I guess it's not something that most people have to go through. But due to legacy reasons, like when I opened my developer account originally back in 2012 or something, back when you had to fax Apple like a signed contract or something in order to open your developer account. Back then, I was, I think, 18 years old or something. I don't remember. It's too early for me to do that kind of math. So back then, I didn't have a company. I was just me, and I opened an individual developer account. And I kept using it until late 2021 as an individual developer account. If you looked at my apps in the App Store, they showed up under my name. But there are several reasons why one might not want to do that. I guess in most countries, it would have to do with tax reasons or accounting reasons. But there's also like liability stuff and things like that. So the company I opened is basically the equivalent to an LLC, so limited liability company. And having all of my apps sold under this company is safer in terms of legal stuff, and also is better for accounting reasons. And since I'm now completely indie and I am selling my apps, and I plan on selling more apps, and that will include selling more apps through the App Store. Not all of my apps have to be distributed outside the App Store like everybody is. I decided to take the plunge and do that. So I was scared, like I mentioned. I was really, really scared that something would break or something would go wrong. And I wasn't even sure to begin with whether it was even possible to do it. But I quickly found out that it was by doing some quick Googling and asking some friends. So the thing is, you can't really transfer, at least not officially, you can't transfer apps from an account to another if those apps use things such as iCloud. I guess something about Apple system ties like your CloudKit containers to your developer team. And if you open another account, that's another team. And I guess they don't have an automated process to transfer those containers. And what I heard, and I don't have confirmation, but I heard from some people that you can, in fact, transfer apps that use iCloud, but it's a manual thing that you have to contact Apple for, and it can take a long time or something like that. So don't quote me on that. Apparently, there is a way. But since I didn't plan on shipping any more apps under my personal account, I thought it might be easier to transfer my account, so basically convert my personal account into a business account. And fortunately, Apple has a process for that. And spoiler, it was super smooth for me. Like, my experience was very good with this process. So I decided to share it here to maybe give some peace of mind to people who are thinking about doing the same. But again, your mileage may vary. I've had a really good experience, but maybe for some people, it might not be such a good experience. So the way it worked is I went to Apple's developer support website and sent them a request. There's no like specific thing you have to select. You just like say account issues or something. And then you tell them, hey, I would like to transfer my account into a company account. And this was this is an important aspect. This was during the Thanksgiving holidays in the US. So I guess their team wasn't even working. I guess I sent the message on Black Friday, but on Monday I received a reply explaining the process. I then asked them a few questions. So the questions I had were, will this affect my usage of iCloud at all? Because I was worried that like after the transfer, all of my users' iCloud data would be inaccessible or something. That was one of the things I worried about. Will the team identifier stay the same? So that bunch of letters and numbers that identifies your development team, I wanted to know if that would still be the same after the migration. And I also wanted to know what would happen to my participation in the small developer program.
Right.
Would I lose my special like 15% thing because of the small developer program, because my personal account was a part of the small developer program? And the good news is that you keep your participation in the small developer program as long as you qualify. So switching from a personal to a business account has no effect on the small developer program. The team ID stays the same, which makes sense, but I just wanted to confirm. And it doesn't affect iCloud or any features that you use with your applications. That was very clear from their response, like, don't worry, everything is going to work, nothing is going to break. They didn't say it like that, but basically that was what they were trying to say. And okay, so I confirmed that I was ready to start the process. They sent me a link, and when I opened the link, I signed in with my Apple ID, my personal Apple ID for my developer account. And it was an online form, basically like a let's get your company info form. So I filled in all the info, submitted the form. Like 30 minutes later or something, someone called me from Apple, and they called me from Brazil, actually. So it was they talked to me in Portuguese, so I didn't even have to speak any English to do this. They just wanted to confirm some information and ask me some questions. Then they let me know that an agreement would show up in the developer portal. I logged in, there was an agreement. I signed the new agreement, received an email asking to update my tax and banking info in App Store Connect. I did that, and a couple of hours later, all of my apps in the App Store were already showing up with my company name. So in total, between me sending the original message, and keep in mind this was on Black Friday that I sent the original message, up until I had my apps showing up under my company name in the App Store, it took less than a week. So I give a huge thumbs up to this process.
Very cool. That's really great to hear. And it's, I guess, one of those things where you don't hear about all of the times when everything goes super well, right? Yeah. You only hear about when something goes wrong. So it's easy sometimes to think that, oh, transferring an app or transferring an account must be really complicated, because we've heard about the cases where something went wrong and it wasn't possible to transfer this particular thing. But it's great to hear that your experience was so smooth, and hopefully that will be the same for a lot of other people. And I guess that the fact that the team ID stays the same, that's kind of the key to this whole thing, right? Like, that's the reason why iCloud probably keeps working and everything keeps working as expected, is because kind of on the back end, like on the server or, you know, in the Apple system, nothing really changes. The only thing that changes is, like, you know, what's the legal entity associated with this ID, right? And that's, I guess, why everything can keep working, which would be different if you would be transferring your app to another account, where presumably then that app would need to take on that new account's team ID.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you are on a new account with a different team ID, you won't be able to sign the app with the entitlements of the previous team. So you couldn't do things such as iCloud and app groups and things like that. The app group folders themselves are prefixed with the team ID. At least they are on macOS. I don't know how that process goes, the manual process, which supposedly is possible. It was a very good experience. So if you are in that situation where you're considering doing this and you're thinking about it, I would say go ahead. It was really fine. The only thing I would say is, I really made sure that I had all of my company data and all of my company setup ready for it, such as, like, you need a DUNS number for Apple, and I made sure to get my DUNS number before I started the process. So make sure you have everything you think you'll need before you start the process. I guess if I didn't have all of that... Also, another detail that I think is important to know, I had to create a website for my company.
Right.
This was like the only thing that I found weird about the process. Like, they require the company to have a website. So you can go to buddysoftware.tech right now, and you can see my beautiful company logo that I made in Sketch in 2 minutes.
Well, Rambo, that's how you know it's a real company. If it has a website, it must be a real company.
Yeah, of course. So they require a company website, and they also require a company email address on the domain of your company. I guess that's just like one way to verify that you actually own the company or something. So yeah, keep that in mind. So if you're thinking about this, your company is going to need a website. The domain has to have something to do with the name of the company or the legal name of the company. And you will need an email in that company domain. So I signed up for like a Google workspace real quick and set up the MX records and whatnot. But yeah, it was overall a very easy process. And you mentioned transferring apps. So transferring apps itself, as long as they're not using iCloud and things like that, is actually quite an easy process. I've done that before as well. And it's basically fully automated. There's like a button in App Store Connect or something. And then the other party, the other company or the other developer just accepts the transfer and that's it. So transferring an app itself is not very difficult.
Very cool. That's great to hear that there's this flexibility in the system in case you want to change your company or want to move an app to a different account.
Yeah, the only problem I have, like the only complaint, if I can call it that, is that you have to use your company legal name in the App Store. So I can't show under my apps in the App Store, I can't show Best Buddy Apps. I have to show Buddy Software Limited. So that's the only complaint I would have. You can't use like your company marketing name. And I'm pretty sure that when I set up the account, which was a brand new account for my other company, they offered me an option to fill in like what the name was going to be in the App Store. But for some reason, when you do this transfer, you can't change the display name for some reason. And I actually asked them and they confirmed, no, you have to use the legal name. So that's like the only downside, I would say.
All right. Well, that's good to know. All right. So very interesting to hear what your experience was migrating your Apple developer account. But what do you say, Rambo? Should we now round off this episode with an Ask Stacktrace question?
Absolutely.
All right. And this one is a really fun one. It comes from Fernando. And Fernando asks, can you guys do a what's in my bag or 10 things I can't live without segment like GQ does in their YouTube videos, where you show and talk about what you carry in your bag at all times and what you carry when you travel? So Rambo, I thought this was a really fun question for us to answer here. So besides your like laptop and things like that you probably bring with you when you leave the house, is there something in particular that you just can't leave the house without when you're traveling or just like, yeah, leaving the house in general?
I guess there's no question people can ask that we can't answer with "it depends."
Yeah, well, that's the Stacktrace signature, right?
Yeah, so yeah, it will depend a lot on the type of going out that it is. Like, am I going out to a coffee shop to do some work when that was a thing? Or am I going to visit my family for a weekend? Or am I going on a trip to Switzerland for a tech conference? Like, those are very different bag scenarios, basically.
Right.
But mostly, it's just my computer, which these days would be the M1 MacBook Air. I always have a bunch of different types of power adapters. So I'll have an iPhone charger, an iPad charger, a Mac charger, cables for all of those things, USB-A cables, USB-C cables. There is a pocket in front of the backpack that I use where I just fill it up with all sorts of cables and adapters and things like that. And I try to like organize them neatly, but it's usually like when you're going to wherever you're going to, they are very well organized, and on the way back, they're just like all jumbled up in there and yeah. But yeah, power adapters, things like that. These days, also 70% alcohol in one of the side pockets, a little like small one. It's something you need. A few masks these days as well in
right.
One of the pockets. Some disposable ones, some reusable ones. When I travel to another country, I always bring with me one of these little kind of like quote universal power adapter things. I have one here. I can probably look up a link from Amazon or something. I don't remember like the brand or the name. It's kind of like an off-brand one, but it's really neat because it pops out different types of wall plugs so that you can plug your stuff in. And it also has, I think, 4 USB-A ports, so you can charge like an Apple Watch and an iPhone. And it also adapts any kind of plug to any other kind of wall socket. So it's a very versatile and very good when you're traveling somewhere and you don't really know what kind of outlet you're going to expect. The only place where it didn't work perfectly was when I went to Argentina for Swiftable, BA Swiftable, and their wall sockets are really weird. I haven't seen them anywhere else. It did work, but it was very unstable, and I was scared that I was gonna shock myself or something. But yeah, I think that's mostly it. Like, I don't really carry a lot. And of course, these days, there's also an AirTag inside of my backpack, but that's a given.
It's funny, you say you don't carry a lot, but that sounds like a lot to me. That's like a long list of items.
I mean, it's mostly just cables and adapters. That's all small stuff.
Right. So thankfully now these days, I've been able to not carry too many adapters, like, or too many cables and so on. Like, if I have a USB-C cable, I can charge my iPad and my laptop, which I have now, which I haven't been traveling with that much yet, apart from like going to the car shop to get my winter tires on the car and stuff like that, like, and waiting there. That's the only trip that I've been taking with the MacBook Pro so far. But other than that, of course, iPhone charger and so on. The few things I usually like to carry with me that are not just like computer equipment and so on, that I think we pretty much all of us who are, you know, Apple users, we have very similar things. I like to always have a polishing cloth in my bag because I might want to polish a screen if it gets dirty, but also for my glasses. Like if I, you know, my glasses get dirty, I want to polish them. And I also usually carry like a little tool that enable me to tighten up the screws in my glasses if needed. And it's one of those things where it's so small and I almost never need it because usually like the glasses don't need this kind of tuning, you know, maybe just once every 6 months or something. But it's just one of those things I always like to have in the bag for reassurance that if my glasses would start to feel a little bit wobbly, then I have this tool with me. You know, it's just like a insurance policy. And I also always like to carry something that I can use if I drink a lot of coffee or something and I feel like I have some bad breath. So some chewing gum or something like that that I can just use to improve my breath if needed. That I also something that I really like to have in my bag. But other than that, it's like I like to travel as light as possible. And my plan now is that I will only bring my phone and my laptop. I actually don't wear my Apple Watch at all anymore, so I'm not sure if I'm going to keep bringing that or not. I don't think I will travel with the iPad anymore, so that really eliminates the need for additional chargers and so on. So I will usually just, I think, bring my iPhone charger and my computer and that charger, and that's it for my kind of charging needs, and then just those extra items, and then pretty much good to go.
Yeah, two things that you mentioned there actually reminded me of two other things that I always have in my backpack as well, at least when I'm traveling or when I'm going out for an extended period of time. Let's say like at least a full day out. Of course, I always have a toothbrush and toothpaste in my backpack. Brazilians have this thing, and many times people who are not Brazilian notice that we brush our teeth a lot and all the time. And even like at airports and restaurants and things like that. That's a bit of a cultural thing, I guess. And also a SIM eject tool for the iPhone, just in case. You never know when you might need a SIM eject tool. These days, like when I'm traveling outside the country, I usually get an eSIM from one of the eSIM apps. There are lots of them out there. So that's very convenient and you don't really need the SIM eject tool for the eSIM, of course. But you never know. Maybe something goes wrong with your eSIM or you can't get signal or something. You have to go like to a store to get a SIM card. And yeah, I prefer to have my own SIM eject tool. Who knows what tool the store is going to have and it's going to like scratch your iPhone or something. So I always bring a SIM eject tool with me.
Yeah, it's similar to my glasses screwdriver, right? It's like it takes like no space in your bag. And if you ever need it, if you only need it like once every 20th trip or something, you're going to be very happy that you have it in your bag. So yeah, having those little tools and things just in some pocket in your bag in case you ever need it, I think that's usually a good idea.
Yeah, also a couple of days ago, I was trying to find something and I was looking through my backpack and I found two things that I had completely forgotten about. Actually, three things. I found a mini SD card reader, like a really tiny one with a USB. It's basically like a USB-A port where you can stick a mini or micro SD card in. I also found a flash drive, like a 16 gigabyte Samsung flash drive. And I also found a lightning to headphone jack adapter.
Oh, that's a good one. That's another thing that I always keep in my bag as well. It's another one of those things where I will probably never need it, but if I will, like if my AirPods run out of battery or something, then I always have that with me as well. It actually lives in my bag permanently because I never use it for anything else. So yeah, that's a good one. I was going to say that at least when you were finding old stuff in your bag, it wasn't something food related, like some old sandwich or something that's been lying there for many years. So that's at least good. It was at least some non-organic material that probably didn't smell bad or cause any issues.
Yeah, reminds me of when I was getting ready to move and I found an iPad I didn't know I had and an iPhone SE I didn't know I had.
Well, that seems like a very typical Rambo problem, to find devices that you didn't know you had.
Yep.
All right, so that's it for this week's episode of Stack Trace. Hope you all enjoyed listening and thanks so much for listening. And we will talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.